This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
I am Alberto Grignolo, editor of DIA Global Forum, speaking with you from the DIA Global Annual Meeting in Boston in June 2018. My guest today is Dr. Robert Nelson, who is the Senior Director of Pediatric Drug Development for Johnson & Johnson and recently joined Johnson & Johnson from the FDA. Dr. Nelson just chaired the session titled Regulatory and Ethical Considerations with Placebo Administration Using a Central Venous Access Device in a Pediatric Trial. And he's here with us to discuss aspects of that session. Dr. Nelson, welcome. Tell us first, what were you doing at the FDA before you joined the industry?
Well, I was in the Office of Pediatric Therapeutics, and my position there was around the ethics of pediatric clinical trials. So this particular session was reporting on an advisory committee meeting we had 13 months ago to look at the issue of whether you could put indwelling ports, or what we call totally implantable central venous access devices, into kids, boys with Duchenne muscular dystrophy, even though they might be on placebo for 2 years.
So the issue arises from having a central venous port and being administered placebo instead of a potentially effective drug.
Right. So you have the risk of the port placement with no offsetting benefit. There's a 2 year extension after that, but the issue was, could you place a port when you don't know? It's a blinded trial. You don't know if that's going to be an active drug or placebo within that port for the first 2 years.
So what came out of this session? What were the topics that the session addressed in relation to this issue?
Well, the session presented the process of the meeting. We had a presentation from Donna Snyder, who is at the FDA and was working with me when I was there on this meeting, about the FDA perspective. We had a presentation from John Liu, who is the medical director of Sarepta, which was the sponsor involved, Dr. Perry Shea, who was at the UCLA principal investigator site. And then one highlight of the session, I think, is we had Nicholas Bullers and his mom and dad present. Nicholas has Duchenne muscular dystrophy, and he was the patient that sort of got the process started of holding this meeting a year ago May.
So, what is his age, if I may ask?
He's 13.
This was a burden, presumably. It's a burden of clinical research that comes with the process, essentially. How can this burden be quantified into evidence or data points or scientific discussion, such as those that surround clinical protocols?
I think the only way one, you know, whether you can quantify, it's hard to say. But I think if there had been more patient engagement at the beginning of this process, that perhaps we would not have waited for the time it took to hold this meeting. And so let me explain that. The FDA was well aware of this protocol for up to a year prior to the meeting that was held. And if we perhaps had patient engagement around the risks of placing an intravenous line every week for an infusion, this is a weekly infusion, and kids with Duchenne do not have good venous access, perhaps that would have brought an awareness of this issue earlier in the process, as opposed to waiting till the study was up and running and actual problems began to arise.
Was this a double-blind study?
Yes. The challenge of studies of Duchenne muscular dystrophy and some other diseases is the primary endpoint is the six-minute walk distance. And the six-minute walk distance depends on motivation. There can be coaching. And so part of the challenge is not knowing whether you're on active drug or not on active drug is important to feel that the six-minute walk distance is a reliable measure of one's, you know, muscular function. So it's a blinded trial. So you get the port in, you don't know if you're getting the drug, you don't know if you're getting placebo.
You and Dr. Donna Snyder, pediatric ethicist and team lead at the FDA Office of Pediatric Therapeutics, co-authored a chapter about the study in the second edition of Ethics and Research with Children, a Case-Based Approach. Could you perhaps share some of the conclusions and recommendations from that chapter?
We developed the chapter out of the briefing document that was for the committee. So the chapter walks through the ethical analysis of the protocol. One of the important ideas or concepts is what's called component analysis. So you look at a protocol, and even though the boys who are on active drug would get benefit, the boys on placebo do not. And so you break those components apart. So it walks carefully through that analysis, talks about how one understands benefit and how one thinks about that protocol. and then presents the different options, the complications of central venous access devices, and reports what the committee decided. The committee basically voted 14-0 that it would be appropriate to use ports. And I think an important part of that meeting was precisely the testimony of patients and helping the committee understand the burden of that treatment. So the chapter basically reports that, the goal being to heighten awareness of this particular avenue, if you will, to address clinical trials that do require those kinds of procedures where there may or may not be benefit that would offset the risk.
So the advisory committee voted, as you said, in favor of it. What about the IRBs?
The way this process came about was when the sponsor had submitted the original protocol, the FDA said that it was not acceptable to put a port in because of this risk-benefit analysis. I do know one IRB early on disapproved the study for that reason. I'll be honest, it wasn't clear to me why that IRB did not refer the protocol for review under this, what we call 5054, which is the particular part of the regulations that allow for this advisory committee, but they didn't. So the sponsor made a decision to remove the implantable device from the protocol, and IRBs approved it, emphasizing again the importance of patient engagement. It wasn't until the mother of Nicholas, who was the patient who was having difficulties at the particular site, contacted me, and she actually contacted the IRB and said, you should refer this. And then the IRB reviewed it, referred it, and the process took place.
Coming back to the session, if you had to relate two or three key messages arising from today's session, what would they be?
Two things. First of all, I'm not sure sponsors, CROs, others involved are aware of this process. So that there can be a protocol where one might think it's ethical to do that, but at least in the United States, because of our regulatory framework, it's not approvable by a local IRB. So the first is heightening awareness, if you will, of this regulatory process by which one could have such a protocol reviewed and approved and implemented. So I think that's the first one. The second one, I think, is to underline the importance of patient engagement. In retrospect, we could have had that earlier in the process, but certainly essential to this whole review was the engagement of the patient community. As I mentioned, Aaron and Brett, Nicholas's parents, Nicholas himself with Duchenne muscular dystrophy, but also the community, advocacy community, was highly involved in that meeting. So I think those are the two messages, awareness of this process, but also the importance of patient engagement.
Do you think that FDA's recent activities on patient-focused drug development and engagement with many different patient groups will help maintain this awareness, and for future programs that involve unusual interventions, this process of engaging patients early will actually, you know, be implemented and used more so than it was in this case?
You know, well, let me draw a distinction. You know, the patient engagement process that the FDA is involved in, I think, is very important. But choosing the sort of diseases that they reach out and getting that kind of feedback in that sort of structured environment is very different than on a protocol-by-protocol basis of getting that patient community engaged. So I think it's not only a lesson for FDA, I think, but also for sponsors to think about how one can leverage early engagement with patients, bring that voice into the conversation with FDA, and then reflect on how that would impact on the protocol itself. So it's always hard to say what would have happened if we had done something differently, because we didn't. But I think it's a legitimate question to say, if we had done that instead of in May of last year, 13 months ago, we could have potentially done it a year earlier and then saved a fair amount of distress for patients that did not tolerate peripheral intravenous access.
Thank you very much for sharing the session and for sharing your insights with us today. Dr. Robert Nelson, thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
For DIA Global Forum, I am Alberto Grignolo.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.